Mr. Taylor, reel 4. So when he got back off leave to HMS Ganges in September 1939, what differences did it all make, that being at war, on your course, and what was happening to you, if it made any difference?
No basic difference. We carried on training just the same. There was the occasional aircraft crossing the coast, and because as soon as an aircraft crossed the coast, being near the east coast, the sirens went, and we all had to dash off down into the underground shelters.
Now, what were those shelters like? Can you describe what they were like?
There was just steps down, and just holes underground, under the playing fields, and there was like a bench all along the side you sat on down there. Some of these interruptions to training become more frequent, this is why they moved us to HMS Impregnable at Devonport. We changed us to Devonport.
That was in May, you went there. Now, anything else happened before we leave Shotley then?
No, I don't think so, no. One of the things, so that you didn't get, I suppose, big-headed, because, you know, I told you there was a grading on the sparkers, having to have the top sort of rate or advanced class seamen. On Saturday mornings, this was your main duties on Saturday mornings, was big clean-ups everywhere. But what they used to do was the seamen boys went into the signal school in the nice warm classrooms, polishing desks and polishing floors and sweeping up, that sort of thing. And they had a heavy gun battery which overlooked the River Orwell. And the shutters along, they could open these shutters, these big 6-inch guns are all along there, and wooden decks. The sparkers and the buntings had to clean the heavy gun batteries, and we had to sort of roll our trousers up and be in bare feet. The instructor used to come out with nice big leather high boots on, knee-length boots, and he had a hose of salt water, and it was freezing, and they had these hard scrubbers, long-handled scrubbers, and used to scrub all the decks and with this icy cold water. And sometimes the bristles of the broom would hit your mate's foot, and it was murder-like. But that, you know, we never cleaned the signal school. It was the seamen cleaned the signal school, and we cleaned the seamen's heavy gun battery. You see, that was to keep us all, you know, humble, shall we say.
Anything else about Shotley, about HMS Ganges? Or is the next thing to move in May?
I suppose a big event there was every Saturday evening you had a cinema in the gym was changed into a cinema.
Well, tell us about that. What was it like? What was the show?
And the thing you used to do, because I say you only had this threepence a week pocket money, I think I got made a leading boy because they had a leading boy and a PO boy. And I got made leading boy, and the PO boy was... one above him. The leading boy had one stripe on his arm, and the PO boy had like a crown. And I think you got sixpence. It was your own money, but you got sixpence then, if I remember rightly. But when you went to the cinema, in the naffy you could buy what we called a Charlie. Now it was like bread pudding, flat bread pudding with, you know, sort of a pastry either side. And it was cut into little squares. And you could buy Charlie for a halfpenny, and you used to buy a bottle of pop, and you used to go to the cinema, and it was all forms across. And the amusing thing is, in the cinema, you'd all be sitting down there waiting for the film to start. And some boys had come in, and they'd got the PTIs there. And as far as you were aware, the form that you were on across the room was full up. And the PTI would say, "Everybody on this line, stand!" And you'd all stand up. And he'd just give you a shove and then stick a boy on the end line. He always made room for one more. But that was a big thing, our cinema on the Saturday night. We were eating our Charlie and having our bottle of pop. That was
and what sort of films were they showing? I mean, are these training films or are these commercial cinema?
Commercial cinema films, entertainment films, yeah.
And what was the big favourite at the time?
I can't remember now. Just can't remember what we saw. Yeah.
But it was popular stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We always used to look forward to that, yeah.
Anything else about Ganges, or should we move on?
Move on, I think.
So, in May 1940, this is when you go to
HMS
Impregnable, which is, where's that?
In Devonport, St Budo. Yeah, St Budo, which is just right around from Devonport.
St. Budeaux.
St. Budeaux, B-U-D-E-A-U-X.
And what was that like? It was a continuation training.
Basically, continuation training of Ganges. They didn't have the big mast that we had there, but we were mainly getting on that stage where we're in more onto the. You still had to do your square bashing and rifle drill and that sort of thing, but you're more into your communication training. While we were there. The war started, they started having to house ordinary seamen and that sort of thing off ships. You were coming off ships between ships or waiting to go to ships, and because of the shortage of space around, so we started getting chaps from ships actually occupying some of the billets in St. Budeaux. So they were entitled to smoke. They couldn't tell the difference between these and the boys, because the boys are all big fellas anyway, you know. So then you were allowed to smoke at certain times, you know, sort of more or less what they call in the dog watches after instruction. You could smoke in certain places. But then we just continued our training there until we finished.
And anything new you were learning there? Or have we covered most of it? We
covered most of it. I mean, it's just a continuation. Mainly moved us because of the interruptions to our instruction at Ganges from the...
Did the whole of the school move, or just the communications
rate? Yeah, they all moved.
And what about Devonport, a bit nearer the sea? Was that where you had this adventure with the submarine?
No, that was at Ganges.
That was at Ganges.
That was on the River Stour, yeah, just by... She was anchored just off Harwich, yeah, so...
Yeah. So anything happened to you, any sort of personal adventures or things that happened?
Nothing special, not at St. Budeaux, no. Just carried on.
And how were you examined, the various stages? Because you seem to have gone from boy first class, boy telegraphist, all this sort of thing at various stages. Yeah. What were the examinations like? Or tests?
You just had to do your various, you got a test on procedure. You obviously test Morse reading, test on Morse sending. You were obviously tested on your kits all the time because you've got your kit test, and obviously assessed on your rifle drill and prey ground drill and that thing. But you know, the main test, you know, was mainly your communications skills, those tests, you know, getting you up to the standard so that you were fit to go to sea.
What were living conditions like on impregnable? Because she was an old wooden... Was she an old wooden ship?
Oh, no, she was shore-based.
I'm thinking of the wrong thing, sorry.
Yeah, there was an impregnable one. No, she was a shore-based at St. Budeaux, yeah.
And was that just huts the same then?
Yeah, huts the same, yeah, more or less the same, yeah.
And so what happened when you came to leave it? I mean, you were there until October, early October 1940. Yeah, yeah. So you were there for quite a long while, five months or so.
Boys' training was about 18 months. This was why, basically, we were so good, because after the war started, they were calling up men to serve. And, I mean, they were doing communication training, say, in 3, 4, 5, 6 months. But we, you know, and in that time, I had to learn a bit of square bash and how to salute and that sort of thing. We'd had 18 months training, so we were good.
That's as pre-war regulars, because you were going to be regulars.
Yeah, we were good, you see. I mean, which was understandable, because our training was intense and long drawn out.
So where did you go? Where did you leave Impregnable for?
Went to the Royal Naval Barracks in Portsmouth for drafting.
That's HMS Victory Barracks.
Yeah. Of course, at that time there... The signal school was in there. It was in what they call KK block, because the Royal Naval Signal School, I wasn't there at the time, sometime during the war, they took over Lady Peel's estate at Leydean near Petersfield in Hampshire. And that became the maximum. But the actual Royal Naval Signal School was in KK, what they call KK block in HMS Victory.
And were you actually attending that, or were you just in the barracks waiting?
Just come in the barracks waiting to go on draft.
What was life like? Because... You've been in there 2 short days. What was life like in the barracks, the naval barracks? Any different?
Yeah, it was packed, and I mean, the messes were overcrowded because the people were being called up, that sort of thing. And I always found that the people in the barracks, I came back there after I left the Formidable, and I don't think they knew there was a war on in there. I'll mention this when we were on the Formidable, certain things, but I don't think there was any tolerance to people like there was in the training ship or on ships. These people that we call barrack stanchions, and you know, they were holding their jobs down. And I mean, when you went into places like Victory, everybody below a petty officer had to double across the playground. You weren't allowed to walk across the playground, and the playground in Victory was big. And there was always a chief GI wandering around. They always had a whistle on a chain around their neck, stuck in their top pocket. And they saw somebody below a petty officer walking, the whistle used to blow, and the signal for doubling was bang the top of your head and do this, jog your hand up. There's a screamer, "That man!" Blow the whistle, bang. I spent very little time ashore during the war, and I was glad I did.
Now, what was the drafting procedure? You were only there, it looks to me like you were there from early in the month to the end of October,
Yeah.
And what happened when you were drafted? How did you find out? What was the procedure?
As far as I remember, you just get sent for and said, "You're on draft to HMS Formidable," and you had to do when you join a barracks, when you leave a barracks, there's a routine. You go around with a little form which they stamp. You have to go to sort of bedding store to get something. You have to, obviously, they need to know in the writer's office for your pay and that sort of thing. And obviously for men who are entitled. I mean, boys are not entitled to draw rum. All these things. So you have to go around all these different offices and have your form stamped. Then when you leave, you do the same thing again. Stamp it so they know you've left. So every department knows you've left. You turn around and you say, drafted to HMS Formidable, and you say, you ask people around, what is the Formidable? You don't know, you see, because it's a brand new aircraft carrier that had just been built at Belfast, Harland and Wolff's in Belfast.
Now, where were you sent to join her? This is in, 1st of November, 1940.
Yeah, sent up to run. Because trains used to come into HMS Victory. The sort of branch line used to come into Victory in those days. So drafts going out used to sort of board with their kits actually in Victory, and then away you went to wherever you were going. So there was a lot of us going to Victory, going to Formidable, because I say she was a brand new ship just commissioning.
So where were you going?
Belfast, yeah.
What was the trip like?
Can't remember much about the trip actually. Just sort of got the train up and... Because you go up, I can't even remember now whether we went up. Later when I was on the Gore, you went up to Larne, you went up to Stranraer, got the ferry across to Larne and the train down to Belfast. I can't remember whether we did that when we went up there. I just can't remember now.
So what happened when you got there? What were your first impressions when you joined
Brand new ship. I mean, there was a lot of us. And we're all on the jetty alongside looking up at this. And the older sailors, because a lot of old sailors don't like being on big ships because it's a bit like being in the barracks, the discipline, the routine, the bugle calls and that sort of thing. And a lot of the old sailors are saying a few choice naval words about going to a big ship and that sort of thing. But I was excited. It was my first ship like that. But they always sent boys to cruisers and above. You never sent boys to a small ship. So that therefore you were still under strict control, because they were responsible to your parents for you because you were underage. So
And what were your first impressions of this?
Fantastic!
It was big, wasn't it?
Yeah, fantastic shipment. I looked at this and bit of trepidation. So will I cope? It's all there, but excited. My first ship, a big carrier. Because they have a proper boys' mess deck on there. There's 50 boys on the boys' mess deck.
Well, let's go into that. Can you describe the boys' mess deck? Almost like if we were... Because it's difficult to imagine for people now. What was it like?
Well, it was a big deck. It was up forward. You got... on a ship, the mess tables always run athwart ships. In other words, from side to side. So... against the side, because the side of the ship sloped, and then you've got the mess tables at right angles to the side of the ship, and with stalls between. At one end you've got what they call the hammock netting. It's a railed off area where you stow your hammocks, and because above you've got all the bars where you sling your hammocks from. All mesh decks have got channeling where they pump air through, and what they call punkaluvas, little sort of jets. I think it's an Indian name from India. I had your portholes along the side, because in those days the ships had portholes. I mean, nowadays they don't have them anymore, portholes, do they? And lockers all around. And these you had to keep these highly polished, because they were like a chrome, aluminium, but highly polished. And you had your kit in your locker. There was a bathroom, because the boys were kept separate. You had your own heads, your own bathroom. And you had two instructors. Nothing to do. I mean, the boys were a mixture of signalmen, sparkers, seamen. And basically, apart from working, they were also training as well, sort of getting up to date. But as I say, I went straight, virtually, after I'd been aboard. They still gave you, in the wireless office, because you're a boy, they give you your, what we call a biffer. It was the Morse exercise to test your speed and everything else. And virtually from the start when we sailed, I was an operator and I stayed as such. But one of the first joggers I got on there, and I think the chief was trying me out, and they were very good. We had you have a signal officer. There was a senior commissioned telegraphist. Now, in those days, this is what I always wanted to be, was a warrant telegraphist. And he wore one thin stripe, and you had a separate warrant officer's mess on a ship. There was the ratings lived on mess decks. Chiefs and petty officers had separate messes. And there was the wardroom for the officers, but you had a warrant officer's mess. When they'd been warrant officers for quite some time, and I think recommendations and that, they got what they called a senior commissioned telegraphist, or senior commissioned bosun if it was a seaman, or senior commissioned what have you. You had a chief, you had petty officers and leading hands, obviously, and they would then, you would start doing training on the equipment, because you had to learn how to, all about the transmitters, the plug boards, how to switch aerials and all that sort of
thing. Now, what equipment did you have?
Well, on this ship, they called it centralised wireless system. It was a new system, and you had the main wireless office, which is down in the bowels of the ship, more or less. You had what they called a remote control office, and that was one deck above the compass platform where the captain and everybody operated the ship from. You had two transmitter rooms down aft, one on either side, with a transmitter. Now, the centralised wireless system, you had a unit on each operator's desk. There was your receiver. You had a Morse key. And you had a microphone which was on an arm, but in those days, voice communications wasn't that good in the Royal Navy. The Yanks were far better at voice, but we more or less stuck to Morse. And they had a unit there where and had a dial like a telephone dial. So if you were on a certain frequency, through the plug board in the main wireless done by the leading end, you would be plugged through to a transmitter down aft, which was tuned to the frequency you had to use. Now, on that dial, you could turn a switch and switch the transmitter on down aft. You could dial up whether you wanted what they called either RT, which was voice, MCW, modulated CW, which they used to use in those days at times, and CW. That was a type of, normally it was CW. But you could also dial up the power, so you could operate the transmitter, you see. And then you've got the receiver in front of you with the headphones, and that's where you operated from. Now, you had to learn, obviously, every time you went to a different ship, you had different receivers, like the Gore was all American equipment. So, and the transmitters, and you got training during the day. I mean, you had to go cleaning stations. You're allocated, like, some were allocated, the main wireless office or the remote control office cleaning, and transmitter room for cleaning. But then while you're down there, the instructor, although you were cleaning, will also be instructing you on the workings of, you know, the transmitters there, and because you also had receivers and Morse keys down there as well. So in an emergency, the main wireless office was blown up. You could operate. So you get being trained. This is why they sent you on big ships, because you had the people to train you all the time. But the one of the first jobs I got, and it frightened the life out of me, the chief turned around to me and he said, the hydrophones are not working. They've got the hatches to the double bottom open, because the ship had these carriers were built with a double skin. There was a passageway between, but so if the outer skin went, you had another skin, and there was a double bottom, which was right down the bow of the ship with a keel. And he said, the hydrophones are not working. I wanted to go down and check them, and I didn't even know what a hydrophone was at first. And they gave me a spanner, and I went, and because apart from going, you go down as low as you can, then you've got these little plates. You can't hardly call them hatches, which have about 32 nuts on, which the engine room department remove, and you get down. And of course, people have to know you're down there, because you could get shut down there, and no one would know, because there's no sort of ventilation there, and you're going down into where the keel is. And I got down, and because I had to have a wandering lead, as we called it, the long lead with a light on the end. And it's quite narrow when you think of the ship. It's quite, well, I suppose it's like this. And there's the keel there, that breaks the keel there. There's the side of the ship, because there was metal strengtheners, I suppose, for the frame of the ship. So I could have one foot that side, one foot that. But there was all water down here, in where the keel was. And I saw these objects on either side of the ship. They were about, I suppose about 12 inches in diameter, with some nuts on each side of the ship. And I thought, well, they've got to be the hydrophones, you see. So I got this spanner, and I start undoing the nuts, and water started coming. I thought I'd sunk the ship. But what it was, and then I sort of did a bit more, and the water stopped, so I took them off. And the hydrophone base is a very sensitive microphone in there, sort of fitted to the side of the ship. And this is why they weren't working. They were full of water, you see. So I sort of put them all back together and tightened them all up. So I went back up top, you see, saw the chief and said, they're full of water, chief. He said, all right. I don't think they weren't bothered with them, really. I don't think the hydrophones ever did work. I don't think they ever bothered, because it was only, I suppose, for navigation. You normally got other, when you're going into coastal waters, just get the depth, really. But as I say, that was the first experience. But they were very good on there, training. I remember they put me on, I mentioned before about direction and control of gunfire by radio. When we were sailing to go round the Cape to go to the Eastern Med, which was our first job after we'd done all the trials and that sort of.
Well, let's not go on to that then. So when you first joined, one thing I did forget to ask you when you were talking about the mess deck was the hammocks. Because how did you take to hammocks? Because I presume you hadn't used them before.
Oh no, you were taught how to sling a hammock when you were in Ganges, because we wished with them, taught how to sling them, and how to put them up. And when you got the ship, you learned that nearly every sailor had a couple of stretchers. You just got two pieces of wood with a little groove in each end, so you keep them wide. But the most comfortable sleep you ever wished, and warm, nice. You made yourself a little pillow, which fitted in a hammock, and because you had mattresses, and then they were horsehair mattresses because they were considered healthy. And you had a horsehair mattress, and you had a blanket. That's all you needed.
And did it take any getting used to getting in and out of them?
As you grab the bar. I mean, you've got to be fit, and you just swing your legs up, because the bar runs right across, and all the hammocks are slung, and you just swing your legs up and drop yourself in. And quite often, you've got your boots on, and you swing up, keep your legs out, and you've got your body, and then you take your boots on and stick them on top of the air ducting system, you see, because if someone snored, a boot would come across the mess deck.
And what about stowing them away? Was that a big rigmarole?
Well, you're also taught, and this is one of the things when you're it's sort of taught how to lash a hammock up, because if it's properly lashed up and it has seven loops around it, you lash it up seven, and if it's, you know, you lay your bedding out in it in such a way that it's nice and even, and you lash it up with these seven loops, and then the two end bits you sort of fold back and tuck in the loop, and a hammock should keep you afloat for 24 hours in the water. So that was another thing. You see, a hammock, if it's properly done up nice and tight and stiff and that sort of thing, and you just stowed them up end on end, you know, sort of upright in the hammock net in at the end of the mess.
Now, when you first got there, how did you settle in with the other lads on your mess deck?
All right, they're all boys together. I mean, they're all new. They're all sort of starting. When we first sailed, we went up, went north. Of course, we had to do trials in the RSC first, because I think they were designed to do about 39 knots, which was fast in those days. But I did hear the chief stoker said he wasn't saying, but he did a damn sight more than that. And when you saw them moving, the stern was down, and the wake from the ship was higher than the flight deck, coming up higher. So they could move those ships.
And what were the sea trials like then? Let's go on to that, if you don't.
Well, I basically had nothing to do with the sea trials. I mean, you just hear stories from me. But I mean, there's obviously.
Were you seasick at all, though?
I was just going to come to that. From the sea trials, we had to go up to Scarborough Flow because they got the degaussing cables on, and because there's what they call a degaussing range there or something. So they do something which I don't understand. Obviously, travelling through this range, they can neutralise the magnetic field of the ship, you know, with the degaussing cable.
And that was done at Scapa Flow?
That was done at Scapa Flow. So, yeah, this is something I don't understand. But, we sailed up, and of course, you go to go up Scapa Flow, you go around the Pentland Firth. And in actual fact, the Pentland Firth, around the northwest of Scotland, you talk about Cape Horn, you talk about various other places. There's nothing like Pentland Firth in bad weather. And then I think, I remember reading once, there was, I think it was when the, was it Kitchener, a famous general, was drowned on a ship?
He was, yes, yeah. In Pentland Firth, yeah.
Yeah, and a battleship going round the Pentland Firth in World War I lost everything above the upper deck, all the gun turrets, the bridge, the lot. So Pentland Firth can be rough.
So what was it like for you?
And on the boys' mess deck, the funny thing was, we put to sea, and next morning, and because carriers have got a very, very long roll. I mean, we had a lot of old destroyer sailors, and they were seasick, because they used to being heaved around. Because of the weight of the flight deck and the way it spreads out, once they start rolling, they don't seem to stop. You can get in dead calm sea, and they're still doing this, you know, for a long time. And every boy on the mess deck was seasick, except me and old Jacko. And the breakfast that first morning was sausage and beans. And we had trays and trays and trays of sausage and beans. There was boys laying on the floor, or the deck, I should say. A bit of civvy too long now. laying on the floor. They were in the heads, in the bathroom, groaning and moaning, and me and Jacko sat there and made pigs of ourselves on sausage and beans. Couldn't eat it all, obviously. But I've never, ever been seasick.
Any reason? Do you know why? Or?
No. The only thing I found with me personally was that when I never ever got seasick, I get constipated. Amazing thing.
At sea?
Yeah. I'd get constipated when I first, I don't know why. It may have been perhaps lack of exercise or something, I don't know. You're not so much exercising, you're not walking around so much as you are when you're ashore. I don't know what it is, but that was the only thing.
But that would always happen to you? Would it wear off, or would it be for the...
Yeah, wear off, yeah, but it just sort of seemed to get constant.